around the country at air shows. And that team later became known as the Blue Angels. He was a highly decorated fighter pilot in World War II in the South Pacific. He married my mother. I was a much sought-after child, and there was no neglect. There was no abuse. I was loved, and I was educated far beyond my emotional ability to handle it. Very shortly after I was born, my father became part of the first squadron to test whether jet airplanes could be used on aircraft carriers. And we moved from Southern California to Quonset Point, Rhode Island. And not too long after that, he became a test pilot with McDonald Aircraft Company in St. Louis, Missouri. So we moved there. And after 2 years in St. Louis, when I was about 5 years old, we moved to Orlando, Florida. And they built a house that remained our residence for the rest of my father's naval career. Even though we moved to other places, that home in Orlando was there. It was not rented. It was home. Where we were was well known to me to be just a temporary way stop. So I don't even have the sand in my shoes of a normal military brat. I've lived in Orlando, Florida since I was 5 years old, even though I had some extended periods in Virginia and Pensacola. When I was about to go into the first grade, they gave a series of tests to all of the incoming first graders. And I never knew what my score was on that test, but apparently it was quite high because the principal came and talked to my mother and told her that I had a lot of potential. I am here to tell you, at 60 years old, that potential has been well guarded and not much used. I had a good childhood up until I got into the seventh grade. And for years I thought that I had an unusual problem because somewhere in between sixth and seventh grade, this evil genie came out of me, and what was a happy childhood all of a sudden became, I'm not enough. The girls that I want to be attracted to me are not. The world is no longer my oyster, and I don't feel up to it. I have since learned that that's simply called adolescence. But for a long time, I thought it made me unique. My father retired from the Navy when I was in seventh grade, and I had always expressed a desire to be a naval aviator, just like my father. I grew up on naval air stations. To this day, the sound of a jet taking off still gives me goosebumps. I love it. And since I had all that potential tucked safely in my pocket, my parents were wondering what's going on with this kid. So finally, in my junior year of high school, they came to me and said, "Do you still want to go to the Naval Academy?" And I was a little perturbed by being asked a direct question like that. I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, if that's your goal, the C's that you are making aren't going to get you there." I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, we have a plan. There is a military school in New Jersey that has two special appointments to Annapolis." At that time, and probably still today, the only way you could get to the Naval Academy was to be appointed by your congressman. And so there are very few openings. And I was not at the top of the heap to get one of them. But this particular school had two that they could make themselves because of the quality of their education. And they said, "Do you want to go there?" And I said, okay. Didn't want to make waves, and I knew it was impossible because I had friends who had been trying to get into private schools, and they had their applications under review for months. This was August for the school year starting in September. I knew it wasn't going to happen, so why irritate the old folks? So I said, okay. And they said, let's go up and see the school. So we got in the car and drove up to New Jersey and looked at this. I mean, it was something out of Charles Dickens. The paint was coming off the walls. You know, the smells coming out of the cafeteria were, you know, paint fumes. My dad looked around and said, well, don't worry about it. They're running a summer session. They'll clean it up for the new school year. I said, okay. So we got in the car and drove home. We drove in the driveway, opened the mailbox, and the letter from the school accepting me was there. It beat us home. So about 2 weeks after that, I am leaving an 80-degree day in Central Florida with blue sky, getting on the train to go to a gray 40-ish degree temperature in New Jersey. And I'm thinking, what in the world has happened? At that particular school, if you were a first-year student, you had to run between classes. You had no status in the school at all, and you had to run between classes. I was a senior, but I still had no status, and I was running between classes. And about, 2 weeks after I got there, one of the big men on campus, one of the officers, beckoned me over, and he said, we heard about your father. And I said, what about my father? And they said, the first commanding officer of the first nuclear submarine was a Captain Parker. And so when my father, another Captain Parker, made application, they thought I was him. It was too late to explain the discrepancy. But after a little while, I got the feel of the place, and I found out just how far I could push all the boundaries, and I pushed everyone without getting in any trouble, which is remarkable. But somewhere in the springtime of that last year, a group of us got together and decided it would be a good idea to go to New York and get drunk. You know, kind of a coming-of-age party or something. And that was my first experience with alcohol. I have not talked about alcohol up until now because there wasn't any. So we went up to New York, and we got drunk. And I remember we checked into the Hotel Manhattan, and we had a room on the 30th floor, and there were some dancers from the Midwest. They were there for some kind of dance competition, and they got together with us. And we were ordering drinks from room service and buying bottles of whatever. I mean, just, you know, mixing and matching whatever we could. And I can't say that I had a blackout. I would probably describe it as a gray out, where everything kind of gets very foggy, but there are a few bright lines around the perimeter. And I specifically remember getting very hot in the room, just like this room was a couple minutes ago before the air came on. Thank you, Fred. And I went to the window and I opened it, and back then they didn't have the safety features you had now, and I remember leaning out into the air, and somebody grabbed the back of my pants and pulled me in. Or you would have a different speaker tonight. And I got sick. And the next day I woke up with a hangover. And I had to take this bus ride for a couple of hours back to school. And I said, no more of that. There was no magic in that evening. Now, I still believed I was going to go to the Naval Academy. And I kept going down to Philadelphia to take physical exams because they kept telling me I needed glasses. And I kept saying, no, I don't. No, I don't. And they said, yes, you do. And finally, they said, you can't come down here. You know, enough's enough. So there I was in my senior year of high school. I didn't know what to do, so I might as well go to college. So I wrote to the University of Florida and asked for an application. And they said, call us next year. We've already got our class filled for this year. You're so late, we're not even going to send you an application. But my best friend had been talking about going to a school in New Orleans for years. So I figured, well, he's my best friend, I'll go with him. And I wrote, sent my application in, and damned if they didn't accept me. He ended up at Emory. But there I was in New Orleans. And that's the true reason of how I got to Tulane. The reason that I like to tell, because it makes me look better, is that that summer, Playboy ran a top 10 drinking schools survey. And, you know, the University of Florida was up there, and you know, lots of, you know, Indiana, all these good party schools. And then down at the bottom, there was a little asterisk that said, these are amateur schools. We don't rate professional schools like Tulane. So my story for years was that's why I went there. It wasn't. They were the only ones who'd let me in. Now, between those two events, that drunk in New York and my getting to New Orleans, I had had some drinking experiences. But they were few and far between. A friend who had a fake ID would get some beer, and I might have one. But again, no big deal, and I didn't particularly like it. But I got to school, I got to college, and I looked around, and it seemed to me that the guys who were really popular were the really big party guys, the heavy drinkers. And they would go to the parties, and back then, you opened beer with a can opener, and you'd make a hole in the top and drink it. Well, these guys would hold it up and take the can opener and punch a hole in the bottom of the can and hold it up and just let it flow into their mouth in one solid stream. I thought that was so neat. So I set about becoming an alcoholic. Now, that wasn't my thought at the time, but looking back, that's exactly what I was doing. My drinking increased, and my drinking increased, and my tolerance increased, and pretty soon I started to enjoy it. I like to say that I am an alcoholic by persistence. I did it the old-fashioned way. I worked for it. My potential was still very much unused. Just enough to get by. That was my motto. I thought I was winning the game of life if I got the highest possible results with the least amount of effort. So, I'm coming to my senior year of college now. There's a war going on in Southeast Asia. I knew I wanted no part of that. I did not want to be all that Uncle Sam could make me into. So I had I used a little of my potential. I had a good idea. Back then, you could stay out of the military if you were a student, but you could only get that deferment until you got your first degree. So I applied to law school. My first semester of senior year, and I got admitted. So I had it set up that I would never graduate until about 7 years later. What an idea! Right! But there's a problem with that, because law school was a little more difficult than undergraduate school. They wanted you to use a little more of your potential. And I have I would like to say I'm over it, but there are remnants of it left. My approach to a problem, if it appears to be overwhelming, I take off. So I spent my first year of law school, my first semester of law school. Now, everybody else had been there for half a year and knew a half a year more than I knew. And I really felt like the class idiot. So rather than feel like that, I got in the habit of taking, I had a little Volkswagen, a little bug Volkswagen, and I would put a couple of quarts of beer and a mystery book in my Volkswagen and drive out to Lake Pontchartrain and spend the afternoon drinking beer and reading mysteries. But there's a bill to come due, and that bill is called final exams. And in law school, they don't grade you on book reports and mid-6 weeks exams. There's one exam. And if you don't make it, you're out. And then I could be all that Uncle Sam wanted me to be. So I was under the gun. Now, on one of these trips to the lake, I'd run into the back of a car, so I had no headlights in my car. That's important. That's important. So I made a solemn oath about 2 weeks before exams. I made a solemn oath that for the next 2 weeks, I will not drink anything, and I'm going to really cram and study and get ready. So that was Friday. Saturday, my parents called and said, "We're going to come into town tomorrow. We'd like to visit you." And I said, "Great." And then things happened that they couldn't make it. So this is Sunday, and I call the woman that I'm dating, and I said, "Well, my parents were going to come into town, and we would have gone to dinner, right?" "Right." "So let's go to dinner." Okay. Now, if my parents had come into town and we had gone to dinner, we would have had a drink, just to be sociable, right? "Right." "So let's have a drink." So my solemn oath lasted from Friday until Sunday. Now, the restaurant we went to was a place called The Raven that served pizza and had a full bar. And I remember about 6 o'clock that night, I was sitting on a bar stool and I was looking out the open door and I was watching the sun go down. And my last conscious thought was, "I better get home. I don't have any lights on my car." And the New Orleans police are not known to be very nice to out-of-town college kids driving around without lights in their car. That was my last conscious thought until I woke up in my bed at 3 o'clock the next morning, and I went out and looked in the parking lot and looked at my car. It was there. I have no recollection from the time that I said I better get out of here to waking up what happened. Mary and I went back to New Orleans, I guess about 6 years ago, and we went to that bar. It's changed the name, but it's still there. And I looked around the parking lot, and there is still absolutely no recollection. If I had known then what I know now, I would know that I had passed over that first line into alcoholism. The fact that I went to New York to get drunk, I don't think has much to do with my alcoholism, because I did exactly what I intended to do. And normal drinkers occasionally intend to get drunk, usually around New Year's or Super Bowl or something like that. But when they intend to stay sober, they don't get drunk. But alcoholics get drunk when they intend to stay sober, like I did that night. That is the first time that I can definitely say that I had crossed over the line into the physical manifestations of alcoholism. 18 years later, I was practicing law in Orlando. I had a client who was charged with electronic theft, electronic fraud. He claimed to be fixing television sets, and they set him up with marked components, and after he gave a bill saying that he replaced these components and they had the marks to show that he hadn't done it, they had him pretty well dead to rights. And we were coming up on trial, and I knew that I better be pretty sharp. And we went out to dinner with some friends. My intention was to have one drink, maybe a glass of wine, just to be sociable. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up. I was still drunk. By the time the day of the trial, the 9 o'clock, the jury selection came, I was in no shape to do anything. And it was the grace of a power greater than myself that got me through. We got a mistrial, and so nobody got hurt. But that scared me. Those are the only two instances that I can really remember where all of the circumstances around me said, don't get drunk. My intention was not to get drunk, and I did it anyway. But I got to tell you, normal drinkers never, ever, ever have that experience. Most of my drinking, I just drank. I got drunk sometimes. I didn't get drunk sometimes. I just drank. But those times, I intended not to, and I couldn't keep the promise to myself or to anybody else. So I graduated from law school, surprisingly, and I went in the Navy. I managed to follow my father's footsteps because at that time, they had just started a new program that they'd made a television show about a few years ago called JAG. And I was in one of the very first classes. Now, the reason why I got in there was not because my grades were so stellar. They weren't. It was not because I was such an exemplary young man. I wasn't. I got in there because they found out that my father was a decorated war hero. And they mistakenly believed that the fruit could not fall that far from the tree. I was about to show them. About this time, I was starting to feel age catching up with me, and I decided that I would get married. And there was a woman who loved me. I knew that I did not reciprocate that feeling, but I figured, what the heck, I might as well go ahead and do it. So I got drunk and we got married. And I went in the Navy, and at this point, all of the governors of my drinking were gone. The thing that kept my drinking down primarily up until that point was I just didn't have a lot of money. And after I became a commissioned officer, I had all the money that I knew what to do with. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was more than I'd ever seen. And besides, you could drink on base for pretty cheap. So I began my career as a drunk. I ended up at my one and only duty station, which was Great Lakes, Illinois, outside Chicago. The reason I went in the Navy was, you know, you moved around a lot. Well, the year I went in, they ran out of money. So they, instead of 2 2-year tours, I had 1 4-year tour. So we got to Great Lakes, and I took a look around at the men, and they were all men at that time who were in the same program as I was, and this was a very select group. The competition for these spots was high, and these men had all graduated very high in their class. They were sharp, they were good, and I knew I wasn't. But I found something at this point, and this is where I moved into the second line of alcoholism. Up until that point, I was drinking primarily for how it looked to you. I was trying to appear as if I were a man in my drinking. But what I found when I was in Great Lakes, when I felt inadequate, when I felt that I was not up to the task, when I felt powerless, I could go to the officers' club, I could order a drink. All of a sudden, I felt more than adequate. When I went home to that wife who I did not love, and I felt very lonely, I could go to the officers' club, have a drink. And feel very loved. At that point, I started to use alcohol to cope with life. And I used it more and more and more. About this time, I took my first trip back to California. Now, I had not been in California since I'd been born. So I went back for the first time. We flew to San Diego, and then we flew up to San Francisco. I fell in love with San Francisco. I just thought it was magical. So I called the man in Washington who sends people wherever they're going to go. They call him a detailer. I called the man in Washington who happened to be someone who had been in Great Lakes with me. We'd played golf together. I figured I had an in. So I called him up and I said, "Bob, there's an air base right down below San Francisco called Moffett Field, and they have a spot for a lawyer. I'll tell you what I'll do. Tell you what I'll do, Bob. I'll extend and give the Navy 4 more years if you'll send me to San Francisco." And he said, "Chet, not only will we not send you to San Francisco, we don't want you. Go home." This is in the middle of the Vietnam War. They were begging people to come in. And they were telling me to go home. That marriage had produced a child. It was not my intention to produce a child. I guess I was part of the process, but it wasn't intentional. Because I knew the marriage wasn't right, and I guess in the back of my mind, I knew that it probably wouldn't last. And I didn't want to bring a child into that situation. And yet, there he was. So my wife and my child came home. He was very sick that day. He'd gotten sick the last night that they were to be in Illinois, and a blizzard in April closed O'Hare. So they couldn't leave the day they were supposed to. They flew down to Orlando. I drove the cars down a couple days later. And he was in the hospital. He was in the Naval Hospital because he had gotten this projectile vomiting. He was dehydrated, and they had to get him in to save his life. And I went to the hospital, and I remember him. He was in these little footed pajamas with little bunnies on him, and he was holding up, and he was so excited to see me. And I took a pass through there, patted him on the head, because the golf course was right next to the hospital, and they served beer at the golf course, and I wanted to get over there and get a beer. And I couldn't get a job. Nobody wanted to hire me. So I took what I thought was a marvelous job for an alcoholic, although I didn't think of myself that way at the time. I went to work for the state attorney's office prosecuting drunk driving cases. Makes sense to me. But there's a problem. Yeah, I know there are a couple lawyers in the audience, and you know, you got to know that there are several types of lawyers. There are the really slick ones like myself. Real slick. And then there's those plotters. You know, they don't have a whole sense of humor. They do their job, they go home to their wife and their children. I mean, they're really boring. And most of the people in the state attorney's office were the column B's. And the slick guys, like myself, for the most part, were defense lawyers. So I was hanging around the bars with them. And my boss called me in one day. I'd been there about 9 months. And he called me in and said, "I understand you've been drinking with the defense lawyers." Well, I was incensed that anybody would be talking behind my back. So I quit. Now, if there are any young people in the room who are thinking about starting a professional career, that's not the way to do it. I figured it was just a matter of time until money and fame came my way, so I went out into private practice. there was a man who had been like a second father to me, a man and his wife, my best friend's parents. And they had become quite wealthy. Disney had come to Orlando between the time I went in the Navy and came back, and they had become quite wealthy as a result of what happened in Orlando. And they were moving from their house that I was a frequent visitor in to a much nicer house. And they made it possible for me to buy their old house, even though I couldn't afford it. And it was a beautiful house, built around a swimming pool. And so we had this fairly elaborate financing agreement where I would pay interest only for a couple of years, and then when my business boomed like I knew it would, I'd catch him up. Well, my business didn't boom, and when it came time to renegotiate or redo the financing and get him off the hook, I cheated him. I finagled the financing in such a way that he didn't get as much money as he should have. And do you know he was mad? Can you believe that? That was one of my slicker deals, and he got mad. And so I got mad at him. I mean, can you imagine him saying that I cheated him? Probably going around town telling people that. Well, now in the meantime, a second son was born. Same as the first. I'm sure I was there, but I don't remember it. And finally, a couple years into it, we took a trip up to Jacksonville, my wife and my children. We had friends who had been in the Navy with us in Illinois who were in Jacksonville. And we took a trip up there to spend the weekend with them. And I got really, really, really drunk. One of those drunks where you pass out or black out sometime in the evening and you wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning and you've got the shakes and you got the sweats and you're trying to remember where you vomited and how much you vomited and, you know, what did you do? And I was embarrassed, and my wife had told me that the reason why I couldn't get a good job was that I drank too much. And I said, okay, I quit. And I quit drinking for 4 years. And at the end of that 4 years, when the good things that I thought should happen to me as a result of not drinking didn't happen, nobody hired me, nobody gave me a good job, nobody threw money my way, I said, what's the use? I've been good. Might as well have some more fun. It's amazing. That was probably 25 or 27 years ago. And I still remember that night after 4 years of abstinence. I went to a Christmas party and I had one beer. I went to another Christmas party and had a glass of wine. And I went to dinner at Steak and Ale and had a glass of ale and a glass of wine, and I went home. That was it. Now, two weeks later, I was driving around in a blackout at 2 o'clock in the morning looking for an after-hours bottle club that I knew I had been to at some point, and I was lost in a town that I had lived in for 40 years. But I still remember that first night after 4 years, I was in control. About this time, it occurred to me that the reason why I wasn't getting ahead was that they were holding me back. Her and them. And what I needed was a relationship with someone more my peer, and that this would catapult me into a fourth dimension. So I left. Now, I left her at that house that we couldn't afford, and I had some friends. I had a good friend who was an excellent lawyer, and I asked him if he would help me out with a divorce. I mean, I didn't need much help, but just a little bit. And we went into some negotiations. The house had to go. That was the only money there was. And so we came up with this proposal that she take the house and the kids and do one thing. And then there was a second proposal that she take the house and the kids and do something else. And there was something about that. That just didn't seem right. You know, either or, take one or the other. I said, Mike, we need to give her a third alternative, just to make it look good, to let her save face. He said, well, what's the third alternative? I said, well, the third alternative is that I'll move into the house and take the kids. He said, you sure you want to do that? Mike, don't worry. She will never, ever, ever take that one. You're ahead of me. 6 weeks later, I moved into the house, the single father of a 9- and 6-year-old boy. Oh, boy. Well, we had to sell the house. That, like I say, that was the only salvation. And in the meantime, I had met my dream woman. I had met her in a bar. Can you believe that you can meet women like that in a bar? Incidentally, I have a little West Coast wisdom for you. If you are seeking a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds are very good. The bad news is the goods are very odd. At least I was. So anyway, I got rid of those kids. I mean, they're a hassle. So I got rid of them. I sent them off to summer camp, and I took my newly beloved down to Martinique for this fabulous romantic week. And something happened. Something changed, and she became very cold and very distant. And I don't know about you, but I have been lonelier in a relationship than I have ever been by myself. And I was incredibly lonely with her on this beautiful tropical island. And so we came back, and I said to her, what's wrong? What has happened to you? And she said, you are crowding me. You don't say that to a man, a macho man. I'm crowding you, honey. You're going to have so much space, you're just not going to believe it. That's the outside. The inside is saying, oh my God, oh, I really need you. I need you real bad. But you can't let that show. So, my kids are gone. I'm a bachelor. I go over to see my friend, the lawyer, Mike, my divorce lawyer. And this afternoon, for some reason, I don't know why, I stuck a $100 bill in my pocket. And I went over, walked into his office, and sitting in his waiting room was a girl, a woman that I knew when we were in high school together. And back then, she was a cheerleader. She was one of the pretty ones. One of the ones that I always knew that if she, yeah, life would be good. So he said, why don't you go over to the Harley Hotel, have a couple drinks, I'll be over and join you. Well, we went over, and we had a couple drinks. When I'm not near the woman I love, I'm loving the woman I'm near. And after a couple drinks, she was loving me too. We drank that $100 bill, plus she bought some drinks. And he never showed up. But about 9 o'clock, this is July 24th, 1984. About 9 o'clock, she looked at the clock and said, oh, I've got a son. First I'd heard of that. So she remembered that she had a son that her parents were looking out for in Winter Garden, which is about 30 miles south of Orlando down the interstate. And so she left. And I started brooding. And I thought, and I drank. And then the idea hit me. Winter Garden is a very small town. I'd never been to Winter Garden, but I knew it was a small town. Winter Haven, small town. And I had this thought that small towns only have one main road. So if I drive down to Winter Haven and I drive down the main road, I am going to meet her. And she's going to see me and know how serious I am about her, and magic will happen. So I threw a couple tall cans in my car and drove down the interstate in an intermittent blackout. I remember bits and pieces of the drive. And finally, it occurred to me, I sobered up enough to realize that this was stupid. I was down near Circus World at that point, and I was being a real clown. So I pulled into a McDonald's to go to the bathroom, and they wouldn't let me in because they'd closed. So I showed them. I drove my car out into an orange grove and turned it over. And I woke up, and the car was on its side, and I had been ejected. And I could look out in the distance and see a light of a hotel. And the thought hit me that if I could get to the light, everything would be okay. I could sleep it off and everything would be okay. So I pushed the car over, got it running again. Didn't run for very long. Next thing I remember, there were blue lights. And I took a ride in a Crown Victoria to the Polk County Jail in Bartow, Florida. And the trooper kept saying, "How much did you have?" Now, I am an experienced trial lawyer of drunk driving cases. You never admit to nothing. Two. Just two. So I had to call my father. He kept hanging up on me from the jail. Calling. Finally, we got through. He came down and picked me up. And the light of July 25th, 1984, hit me as I walked out of the Polk County Jail. And I knew at that point that the jig was up, that alcohol had taken me where I never thought it would take me. And my dad said, you want a couple drinks? You want a beer to steady your nerves? And I said, "No, I'm done. I quit. I can't handle it. I'm done." So I don't know if you all remember your first day of sobriety, but I remember mine. I was standing in front of a judge. I found out that I had soiled my pants. Now, when I say I soiled my pants, I don't mean that I had gotten the knees dirty. During the time that I was unconscious in the orange grove, apparently I had involuntarily pooped in my pants. Now, it wasn't a lot. But you know, when you poop in your pants, they don't ask you how much is a lot. Not only was I standing in front of the judge, I wasn't the defendant. I was the lawyer for the defendant. And I was pleading this guy out to his second DUI. We'd already worked out the deal. This was just a formality. But he wasn't real pleased, I found out later, when he showed up in an AA meeting and saw me. The judge told him he had a problem, and he felt like screaming, "I've got a problem, look at this guy!" But I thought I'd pulled it off. Now, the woman who needed space and I were in counseling. Now, that's not hard to understand. So we went to this counseling session, and the psychologist found out that I'd been arrested for DUI. And he said, "Before you come back next week, I want you to go to an AA meeting." And I said, "You don't understand. I quit drinking for 4 years on my own, and I can do it again, thank you." And he said, "I want you to go to an AA meeting and learn how to ask for help." And I've got to tell you, in the last 22 and a half years, I have been learning how to ask for help. But I went to that first meeting. I put it off as long as I could. But finally, the time was up, and I had to go before the next day. And I went to a meeting at the famous Central Group in Orlando. I was going to go to one meeting. That was it. He didn't say I had to keep going. He just said, "Go to one." And that was it, one. And I walked up the steps, And I didn't, I thought that I was going to go into like a bank building where I'd be anonymous, and there's this great big orange awning, an Alcoan club, and I'm going, oh God, everybody's going to see me going in there. And I walked up the steps, and there was a man standing there. He had a white beard, and he had really clear blue eyes. And I remember looking at him and saying, you know, that guy is at peace with himself. And he shook my hands. He said, I'm Bill Oakley. Welcome. He allows me to use his last name. He said, I'm Bill Oakley. Welcome. And he sent me into a room, and the chairman sounded like a fishwife from Brooklyn.
You know, they got the accent, and gonna tell you how it is.
Then I realized she was a celebrity. She was the red hot mama at Rosie O'Grady. So, you know, it was okay, I guess, you'd be in a room with celebrities. And in qualifying, she said something. She said, you know, I never went to a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol. And that got me. That real simple statement cut right through the denial. It cut right through all the rationalization. Because I never went to a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol. If I went to get a burger, it was going to be a burger and a beer. The only time I would go to McDonald's was in the morning to have an Egg McMuffin because I was not a morning drinker. So I started going to AA meetings because for some reason it felt good. There was a woman in that meeting by the name of Mary, and she'd been sober for a couple of years, and she talked about taking these tests. And there were a lot of people in that room talking about their alcoholism and the place that drinking took them. But none of it made a whole lot of sense except that one statement. I never went to a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol. But it felt friendly. And I kept going back. And something happened that sounds like it's good, but in my case, it wasn't. I got comfortable. I got comfortable going to AA. I got comfortable listening to people quote the big book. I got comfortable, like I say, Bill Oakley was the first person I met. He was a hero to me in AA and still is. And I'd quote Bill. And I got a pretty good line of patter myself, if I don't say so. You know, I thought I sounded pretty good. But I wasn't doing anything. I was going to meetings and I was talking the talk. And I'd been around for about 3 months. And someone said, Bill is speaking down in Kissimmee. If you don't know, it's about 15 miles south of Orlando. He's speaking at an Eaton meeting in Kissimmee. And I said, what's an Eaton meeting? And they say, well, you know, you buy some chicken, you buy something, you know, potluck, you go down and there's a speaker. And so a friend of mine and I got in the car and went down, bought some fried chicken and went to this Eaton meeting. And I got to tell you that for the first 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's about the only right thing that I have ever done. And I do it today. When I hear somebody who possibly has a good handle on recovery, I was willing to get in the car and go put myself in their presence. I met Don P. In Sanford that same way. And before he died, he became another hero of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't want you to think that I didn't do anything. I really did. Because I kept trying to, we don't have the steps posted, but the steps that Mary read. I kept looking at those steps and I kept trying to do what they said. And I had a tremendous amount of problem with the first three steps. And the problem that I had with them was they seemed so ethereal. They seemed so hard to grasp. And surely if you do something as significant as make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, something should happen. You should feel something. You should see something. Lights should flash or dim or, you know, tablets of stone with writing on them. Something. Nothing happened. And so the wisdom that I heard in the rooms was if you're having trouble with one step, you really haven't done the one behind it. So for 7 years, I did what I call the Florida three-step, which is step one, step two, step three. Step three, step two, step one. Step one, step two, step three. Step three, step two, step one. Now, I was busy during this time because I saw God in there, and I knew that this finding God had to be fairly complicated because I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, part of God's frozen chosen. I know that's the Presbyterians, but it fits the Episcopal churches I went to. So I started searching, and I went to the Presbyterians, and I went to the Methodists, and I didn't get anything there. And then I kind of came down, and I got a little more. I went to the Unity Church and the First Church of Religious Science. And I was speaking up here a couple years ago, and a woman came up to me and said, I go to the First Church of Religious Science. Were you making fun of that? And I said, no, there's nothing wrong with that. I was making fun of me. But then I got a little spookier. I went to rebirthing. Past life regression was a favorite. I went to ACOA, OA, any 12-step program that ended in a vowel. I did Course in Miracles before Course in Miracles was cool. And at the end of 7 years, I was still on my 3-step cha-cha-cha. In the meantime, I was chasing a relationship that I knew would heal me. And finally, my latest conquest dumped me Christmas Eve, which is really a nasty time to dump anybody. I spent Christmas Eve taking her presents back. But it freed up enough time that I was able to do something that I intended to do for a long time. And it is so neat that this is the 20th anniversary of the Unity Weekend, and that Fred and Martha have carried it on, and Bob and Ruth started it. They're real important to me. And in 1991, I went to a big book workshop put on by Bob and Ruth that Charlie and Joe did over in Albany. And I began my recovery at that time when I was 7 years sober. Now, the good thing that I can tell you about my experience is that I spent 4 years not drinking and not going to AA. And I spent 7 years in AA talking the talk and not taking the actions. And I can tell you that those two periods of time are essentially the same. There was no great change in my life as a result of either of those periods of time. No more hangovers. That's good. No more shaking. That's good. No more conversations that I don't remember. That's good. But as far as significantly changing my life, nothing. And they actually pointed out something in the big book. Go figure. In the big book, there was an answer to my 3-step cha-cha-cha. There's a line that says we have to ask ourselves but two questions. Do I now believe? Do I now believe? No. Or am I willing to believe? Oh, yeah. Look at all of you, past life regression. I'm willing to go a long way. Way back. As soon as you say yes to either one, you can move on. I made such a deal of the first 3 steps. I expected so much of them, so irrationally. I had to personalize them. I don't believe in rewriting the steps. I don't believe in rewriting the big book. But for me, I had to simplify it. And my concept became, number one, my way don't work. Number two, there's a better way. Number three, I'm going to find it. And that weekend, I sat down and I wrote for the first time the names of the people that I was mad at or afraid of. I was 45 years old. I'd been in meetings for 7 years. And I had 30 pages of names of people that I was mad at or afraid of. And before you think that I'm totally crazy, it wasn't 30 pages like this. it was 30 pages like this with a fair amount of space in between, but that's still a lot of names. And I don't know about you, but I can't stay sober or comfortable long being mad at or afraid of that many people. And I made another discovery. I found that I had put every one of those people on that list. As a result of me demanding something from them that they wouldn't give me or I had to have, every one of those was my creation. And it hit me between the eyes. I became aware of how unmanageable my life was only when I took the fourth step. Well, I wish that were the end of the story, but it's not. I had to do something about it. I had been a miserable father. I took both of my sons, one at a time, to San Francisco. Just as a way, what I had taken away from them was time, and what I tried to give them back was time. Took them one at a time. I didn't even take them together. The man that I had cheated, I went to him and I said, I cheated you. He said, no kidding. I said, I need to pay you back. He said, no, my wife and I have been very successful. We don't need the money. We don't want it back. I said, no, I've got to. He said, are you a born-again Christian? I went, oh, no, not that. I'm an alcoholic. During that conversation, he started to talk to me about one of his sons, and as a result, I was able to help the family involuntarily get that son alcohol treatment to the point that last year, when the son died of lung cancer, he died sober. The woman that left me on Christmas Eve, we got back together, and we were going to get married, and it just wasn't working out. And I said to her, I said, you know, this isn't working out. She said, I know, and that was basically it. That was on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and you know, I thought about it. I mean, this is the end of an almost marriage, almost a sacred affair. You can't just end it with, yeah, I know. I mean, so I decided what I would do is go to the beach. I'd go over to New Smyrna Beach, and I would walk up and down the beach in a lonely way, and people would see me and say, there's a man with a broken heart. It has a little more oomph to it. So I went over, and it was cold. It was March 28th, and it was cold. And there was this cold wind blowing off the ocean. And I don't mind being dramatic, but I'll be damned if I'll be cold. So I did it in a lick and a split. And I got down there, and I looked up at the sky where God is. And I looked up, and I said, God, I'm done. I have chased relationships as long as I can. I have been totally unsuccessful. And I'm done. But if it be your will, if it be your will, would you send me a woman like Mary? Now, Mary had been in my first meeting, and we had become friends. And I mean friends in the honest to God, not wink, wink. We were just friends. And we'd had lunch together after meetings. She had tried to convince me that there really was a God, and I would argue with her. And she was just, you know, she was a beautiful woman. She was smart. She was sensitive. She was humorous. Just send me someone like that. And so I went back to my room to get out of the cold. And the next morning as I was leaving, I decided to leave the next day rather than stay 2 days. The manager came down and handed me a note. And the note said, call Mary. And I asked her, I said, did this come in last night or did it come in this morning? Because Mary was up in Daytona Beach, about 15 miles away, at a workshop. One of the seeking things that I had done was a kind of a expand your horizons workshop, and she was going to it. And the woman said, I don't know. And so I had, what am I going to do, back to Orlando? I mean, if she called me last night, she doesn't need to see me. But what the heck, it's only 15 miles. So I drove up to Daytona. That was on March 28th, on May 13th, Mary and I were married. Now, there's a long story in between there. Not a lot of time, but a long story. And I don't have time to tell it, but, you know, that's a pretty dramatic answer to a prayer. So we got married, and the next thing that happened was my youngest son was going to a military school up in Georgia, and I got a postcard about a parents' weekend, and I said, "Oh God, parents, Atlanta." And then I said, "What would a good father do?" I've been in AA. What do the fathers in AA who I admire, what would they do? Well, they give the time and the money. So I got on the plane and I went up to Georgia. And then my other son was in North Carolina at the school, and a similar thing happened. And we went on for a while, and I didn't recognize the significance of it. But about a year after that, Mary and I were driving, and we detoured 2 hours out of the way to go to that little town outside of Atlanta. My son wasn't even there anymore. We went back to that town, and it hit me. All my life, I had been going in this direction, trying to find happiness, and I hadn't found it. And I did what the people told me to do here, and I had such a good time that I was willing to drive 2 hours out of my way to recreate it, to re-experience it. As a result of taking the actions of the program, I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself that knew better than me what my good was. And as a result of that knowledge, I became more willing to follow that. My dad died. I was 12 years sober, and I had quit my job. I'd gone back to school to become a mental health therapist. I needed to find some somewhere. And I realized I'd made a mistake, and I was going to go back into business. And the one man I knew who had put a professional career back together was a man by the name of Clancy I. I was 4 years sober, and a fellow had given me a tape. He said, "Listen to this tape. He's got a strange message, but listen to it all the way through." And for about 8 years, I had been listening to Clancy and absorbing his tapes. And I knew that he was, again, one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "If there is anybody that I would listen to, it would be him." And so I said, "I think I will ask him if he will sponsor me, and maybe he can help me get this career back." And then I said, "Why would I do that? I mean, he's going to turn me down. He's a busy man." And Mary said, "Well, go ahead and write him the letter. All he can do is say no." And so I wrote him a letter, and damned if he didn't say yes. He said, "Let's see how it works out." So I called him. The first time I called him, I said, because I was somewhat of a hero in my own mind at this point. I'd taken people through the steps. I knew what to do. And I called him and I said, "Well, I guess you want to hear my resentments and my fears." And he said, "No." Nah. He said, "I'm a little more pragmatic than that." He said, "I just want to know what you're doing." And so for the last 10 and a half years, the focus of my life has changed somewhat from how do I feel about doing to that, about that, to what am I doing? My father died, and he had always told my mother that the most beautiful place in the world was Maui when he was flying over in the South Pacific. And my son had been stationed in Hawaii. And so all of a sudden it came to us that we would take my mother to Hawaii, see my son, and go see this place that my father loved so much. And so we went to Hawaii. I didn't want to go to Hawaii. I live in Florida, for God's sakes. I don't need to go to Hawaii to go to the beach. And we went to a meeting. And Mary looks across the room and says, "I know that guy." I said, "No, you don't." He said, "Yeah, I know that guy." So he came up. He said, "You look familiar." Turns out that he had gotten sober in Orlando at the Naval Base. And he was now out there. And he was the director of a treatment center. "Well, hi, yeah, I know, see you." Okay. in December of that year, we got a call from my son. He'd been arrested in the military. He'd been drinking. He was in a blackout. He said, "I need help. I've been drinking for a long time. I didn't want to tell you." We had the name of somebody. We called a friend in Apopka who had spent time in Hawaii. I said, "We're looking for Pat. Do you know him?" He said, "I can get his number." We got his number. He went and picked my son up, took him out of the stockade, took him to his house, and kept him there over the New Year's holiday. Became his first sponsor. My son just celebrated 6 years of sobriety. He's a member of the Pacific Group in California, and he's doing beautifully. Until I took the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea the type of life that I could have. For my 60th birthday last summer, my wife and I were supposed to go to Scotland because I'm a fanatic golfer, and 60 years go play golf at the Cradle, St. Andrews. And then the new terrorist attack threat happened, and we decided that we just didn't want to get on an airplane for 16 hours with no book, no, you know, you couldn't take anything on at that time. So the airline said, you know, you can go anywhere you want to, no penalty. We went to San Francisco. My son, being down the coast, he drove up. He wanted to come up and see us, and I said, "What do you want to do?" He said, "Dad, I want to do exactly the same things that you and I did when we came here." I had always wondered, was that trip for them or was it for me? I found out. I called my other son while we were there. I said, "Chet, do you remember the trip to San Francisco?" He said, "Dad, I remember everything about it, including the weather." Until I took the actions, I had no idea what I was getting. My life has been one where only in retrospect, only after I have taken the actions, do I understand what has happened to me. When I spent all that time trying to find the answer before I did anything, I ended up with nothing. When I did as Clancy said, "Tell me what you're doing," I started to make some progress in life. And if you're new tonight, if my story in any way touches you, what I would pray for you is that you get the glasses that see that your way doesn't work, and you become willing to take these actions that you don't believe in and that you think have no application to your life. I can promise you, as a result of my experience, you'll have a life beyond any that you could imagine. And I thank you for listening to me tonight. Take care.